From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
It's a blatant conflict of interest. James Baker has been going around the world asking for forgiveness for Iraq's crushing debts. Behind the scenes, he's been part of a secret deal to force Iraq to pay its debts to Kuwait. If it works, Kuwait will pay the Carlyle Group, where James Baker is a partner, $1 billion in an investment.
The double life of James Baker. In a major expose, Nation magazine columnist Naomi Klein reveals President Bush's special envoy on Iraqi debt has been playing both sides, offering his services and those of former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to the government of Kuwait to recover billions of dollars in debt. Then the nation's largest local TV network preempts primetime programming to air a controversial anti-Kerry documentary.
Sinclair Broadcasting, can they get away with this? Can they run a partisan attack on Kerry just before the election? Or will an effort to stop them actually work?
And with just a few weeks left before the presidential elections, the FBI has quietly begun questioning Arabs and Muslims across America.
It's a waste of law enforcement's time and resources to contact several hundred people based on religion for friendly and ultimately useless conversations rather than focusing on 10 potential terrorists or criminals based on intelligence.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Britain, calls are increasing for Prime Minister Tony Blair to make a full apology to the House of Commons over the way his government used faulty intelligence to make the case for war against Iraq. Yesterday, the British government formally admitted that one of its main claims regarding Saddam Hussein's threat to the world was false. Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said the government no longer stands behind its claim that Iraq had the ability to launch weapons of mass destruction within 45 minutes. Opponents of the war in Britain are now calling on Blair to come before Parliament to answer questions about Iraq. One Liberal Democrat said, quote, "The Iraq Survey Group report shows beyond doubt we went to war in Iraq on a false premise. The Prime Minister must not avoid these questions any longer, and he should not bypass Parliament," he said. In Iraq, U.S. troops entered Ramadi, arresting a leading Sunni clergyman and raiding seven mosques. The head of one mosque said, quote, "This cowboy behavior cannot be accepted." He said the Americans seem to have lost their senses and gone out of control. Meanwhile, in Fallujah, the daily U.S. air raids continue killing at least 11 people, including two at one of the city's most popular restaurants. The Washington Post reports tension is increasing in Fallujah between the Iraqi National Resistance and foreign fighters based there. The Washington Post reports local residents are now blaming the likes of Abu Musab Zarqawi for the daily U.S. air attacks. One resident said of Zarqawi, quote, "He is mentally deranged, has distorted the image of the resistance and defamed it. I believe his end is near." In other Iraq news, the New York Times reports that the unelected Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, is making moves to allow more former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party back into the new government despite protests from the Shiite and Kurdish populations. Alawi is a former Ba'athist himself. In Baghdad, three U.S. soldiers were killed yesterday when a bomb exploded near their convoy. The total number of U.S. troops killed in Iraq is now 1,072. It is unknown how many Iraqis have died. Meanwhile, back at home, a group of soldiers who recently returned from Iraq have taken the unusual step of producing a TV advertisement criticizing not President Bush, not John Kerry, but the war. The group is known as Operation Truth. The ad features Robert Acosta, who lost his arm in the war.
"I was called to serve in Iraq because the government said there were weapons of mass destruction, but they weren't there. They said Iraq had something to do with 9/11, but the connection wasn't there. They told us that we'd win the war and be home soon, but we're still there. So when people ask me where my arm went, I try to find the words, but they're not there.
the ad with veteran Robert Acosta of the group Operation Truth. A coalition of over 650 foreign affairs specialists calling themselves security scholars for a sensible foreign policy have signed an open letter opposing President Bush and are accusing him of having the most misguided foreign policy since the Vietnam War era. The letter charges U.S. actions in Iraq have made Osama bin Laden more popular in some countries than President Bush. The letter reads, quote, "This increased popularity makes it easier for al-Qaeda to raise money, attract recruits, and carry out its terrorist operations that would otherwise be the case." The signatories include former staff members at the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council, as well as six of the last seven presidents of the American Political Science Association. Meanwhile, former UN weapons inspector Hans Blix has charged the U.S. invasion of Iraq has, quote, "stimulated terrorism around the globe." Blix told the BBC, quote, "I think, like everybody else, that it is good that Saddam is gone. The world is better off without Saddam," he said, "but the world is not any safer. If this was meant to be a signal to terrorists to stop their activities, it has failed miserably. It has stimulated terrorism," Blix said. Haaretz is reporting today the CIA is running a top-secret interrogation facility in Jordan, where it is detaining at least 11 of al-Qaeda's top leaders, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. The news comes a day after Human Rights Watch issued a report criticizing the top-secret detention center. According to the group, the location of the detention center has been so secret that President Bush asked the CIA heads not to report it to him. Until now, the whereabouts of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other al-Qaeda leaders has been unknown. Haaretz reports their detention outside the U.S. enables CIA interrogators to apply interrogation methods that are banned by U.S. law. According to the Human Rights Watch report, the CIA was granted special permission by U.S. law enforcement authorities to operate, quote, "other laws at the secret facility with regard to interrogation methods." Detainees are subjected to physical and psychological pressure that includes the use of simulated drowning, loud music, sleep deprivation, and sensory deprivation. Some of these methods were exposed with the revelation of torture techniques used by U.S. interrogators at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The United Nations and International Committee of the Red Cross are warning the residents of Gaza are facing serious food shortages and on the brink of a humanitarian crisis. Some 15,000 Palestinians in northern Gaza have been living under siege without access to food, water, and hospitals since September 28th, when Israel launched a major offensive that's already killed over 100 Palestinians. To compound the problem, Al Jazeera reports Israel has blocked international humanitarian staff from the UN from entering Gaza since September 21st. In other news from Gaza, Haaretz is reporting the Israeli military has suspended a military commander following the shooting death of a 13-year-old Palestinian girl last week. The unarmed girl was reportedly shot as many as 20 times. Meanwhile, a 10-year-old Palestinian girl was shot in the stomach yesterday by Israeli forces while she was attending a class at a UN school in the Khan Yunis refugee camp. Last month, a 10-year-old girl was killed by Israeli gunfire while sitting at her desk at the same school. And in Hebron, Israeli forces today arrested a senior military leader of the Palestinian group Hamas. The Nevada TV station KLAS is reporting workers at a Republican-funded voter registration company charged that hundreds and perhaps thousands of voter registration forms signed by Democrats were thrown in the trash. The company, Voters Outreach of America, has employed up to 300 part-time workers in Nevada collecting new voter registration across the country. What the company didn't tell the new voters is that it is funded by the Republican National Committee. The workers allege the company sorted through the new registration forms, appropriately submitted the Republican forms, and tossed the Democratic forms. This could possibly leave thousands of Democratic voters who thought they were registered unable to vote in the presidential election. Meanwhile, in Florida, the Washington Post reports that African American leaders are complaining that voting officials in Duval County are unfairly rejecting new voter registration from Democrats. An analysis by the Post found county officials are flagging Democratic registrations at three times the rate as Republicans, and no group has more flagged registrations than African Americans. And in science news, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has soared over the past 2 years, raising new concerns that the world may be on the brink of runaway global warming. The Guardian of London reports some scientists fear that the greater than normal rises in CO2 emissions mean that instead of decades to bring global warming under control, we may have only a few years. At worst, scientists say the figures could be the first sign of the breakdown in the Earth's natural systems for absorbing the gas, which would make the planet's soaring temperature become impossible to contain.
Oh, oppression, you prey on us when we sleep. Oppression. You chase after the tired, the poor, the weak. Oppression, you know you mean only harm. Oppression, you reach out with your long arm. But oppression, I won't let you near me. Ah, no. Oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will. Oppression, you seek population control. Oppression, to divide and to conquer is your goal. Oppression, I swear that hatred is your home. Oppression, you just won't leave bad enough alone. But oppression, I won't let you near me. Oh no, oppression. You shall learn to fear me, yes you will. Oppression, I don't see how.
Ben Harper, Oppression, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major expose published last night on The Nation magazine's website, columnist Naomi Klein reveals President Bush's special envoy on Iraq's debt, former Secretary of State James Baker, has been using his position to benefit his corporate clients and the Carlyle Group, the powerful merchant bank and defense contractor where Baker serves as a partner. According to confidential documents obtained by The Nation, Carlyle has sought to secure an extraordinary $1 billion investment from the Kuwaiti government, with Baker's influence as debt envoy being used as a crucial lever. The secret deal involves a complex transaction to transfer ownership of as much as $57 billion in unpaid Iraqi debts. The debts, now owed to the government of Kuwait, would be assigned to a foundation created and controlled by a consortium in which the key players are the Carlyle Group and the Albright Group, which is headed by another former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. There are also several other well-connected firms involved. Under the deal, the government of Kuwait would also give the consortium $2 billion upfront to invest in a private equity fund devised by the consortium, with half of it going to Carlyle. In a letter dated August 6, 2004, the consortium informed Kuwait's foreign ministry that the country's unpaid debts from Iraq are, quote, in imminent jeopardy. Another letter warns the Kuwaitis that world opinion is turning in favor of debt forgiveness. As evidence, the consortium points out to Kuwait, quote, President Bush's appointment of former Secretary of State James Baker as his envoy to negotiate Iraqi debt relief. The consortium's proposal spells out the threat. Not only is Kuwait unlikely to see any of its $30 billion from Iraq in sovereign debt, but the $27 billion in war reparations that Iraq owes to Kuwait from Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion, quote, may well be a casualty of this U.S. debt relief effort. In the face of this threat, the consortium offers its services. We turn now to Naomi Klein, author of the exposé in The Nation magazine. She joins us from Toronto. Naomi, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you. Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist and author of Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate, and the book No Logo, Taking Aim at Brand Bullies. Her new film is called The Take. Tell us exactly how you learned about this deal, and if you could explain further what it is.
Absolutely. The documents just came to me. I can't really say how they came to me. It was just essentially a leak. And I have them right here. They're extensive. There's 75 pages of documents. 65 pages are a proposal that was submitted to the government of Kuwait by this consortium of companies that you've described. And then the rest are letters back and forth, including letters signed by Madeleine Albright herself, between the government of Kuwait and the consortium, talking about whether or not the deal is going to be accepted. The deal is still under consideration. I've spoken to officials in Kuwait who confirmed that, and I've also spoken to all of the relevant members of the consortium who also confirmed that they're waiting for a response. Essentially what the deal is that Kuwait, at the end of the first so-called Gulf War, as a condition of the ceasefire, Saddam Hussein agreed to pay reparations for the losses stemming from the invasion and occupation of Kuwait. Body was created by the Security Council of the United Nations called the United Nations Compensation Commission. This body assessed claims and awarded reparations claims. It's a little known fact of the occupation of Iraq that even under the brutal circumstances that we know about in that country, Iraq continues to pay reparations. In fact, they've paid $1.8 billion in reparations since the occupation of Iraq started. They've paid, instead of receiving reparations, Amy, they have been paying reparations to this body, the UNCC, with most of the money going to Kuwait. Now, for obvious reasons, these reparations are in jeopardy. Part of the reason why they're in jeopardy is because Iraq has a crushing debt of at least $200 billion, possibly more. About half of that debt is sovereign debts between countries owed by Iraq to other countries in the usual kind of foreign debts. The other half is made up of these war reparation payments, these war reparation debts. Now, in December 5th, 2003, George Bush announced that James Baker, former Secretary of State James Baker, was going to be his special envoy of the president. And that means that it's the president's representative to the world, which means that the envoy only meets with heads of state. They don't meet with ministers, and the envoy reports directly back to the president that this post would go to James Baker because it was such an important mission. In fact, James Baker, George Bush referred to it as a noble mission, and the mission was to meet with presidents and prime ministers around the world and ask them to forgive Iraq's crushing debt in the name of the reparation needs of that country. And of course, there were benefits to this mission for the United States as well, because as we remember, before and after the invasion of Iraq, we were assured by people like Paul Wolfowitz that Iraq's oil revenues would go towards rebuilding the country. In fact, a percentage of Iraq's oil revenues, 5%, continues to go to these reparation payments. So this is an issue for Iraqis, and it's also an issue for U.S. taxpayers. Now, when James Baker was appointed, questions were raised about conflict of interest because of his connection to the Carlyle Group, as well as to his family law firm, Baker Botts. because both of these companies have extensive ties to business interests in the Middle East. Both of them have ties to the Saudi royal family for instance, and the Saudi royal family holds a great deal of Iraq's debt. So naturally, there were questions raised about whether Mr. Baker was the right person for the job. And in fact, the New York Times took the extraordinary step of publishing an editorial after the announcement of James Baker's appointment that called on James Baker to resign both his post at the Carlyle Group, where he's a partner, and at Baker Botts, saying that even if he was even if both firms promised that Mr. Baker would not receive any benefits from any investments at all connected to Iraq's debt, there was still enough of a perception and a threat of conflict of interest that he should resign his private posts if he's going to hold on to his public post. Now, the White House dismissed these concerns out of hand. In fact, George Bush joked that he doesn't read New York Times editorials. He assured the world that James Baker was a man of high integrity. Now, at the time, the Carlyle Group submitted a signed statement, I have a copy of it right here, to Alberto Gonzalez, the White House counsel, pledging, and this was not made public at the time, but I have a copy of it, pledging that they do not have interests that conflict with James Baker's mission. And I'll quote a couple of lines from this statement. They say, Carlyle does not engage in lobbying or consulting, and they also say Carlyle does not have any investment in Iraqi public or private debt. Now, in this statement, they do not say something very crucial, which is at the time of James Baker's appointment, the Carlyle Group was 5 months into, at least 5 months into, negotiations with the government of Kuwait to help secure its debts from Iraq. In fact, members of the Carlyle Group, according to these documents, attended a meeting in London in July, that's 5 months before James Baker's appointment as debt envoy, in which they were commissioned, along with several other companies, to come up with a proposal about how Kuwait could make sure that its reparation debts were not a casualty of these new political circumstances, i.e., the new political circumstances post-invasion. This was July, so just a couple of months after the occupation of U.S. occupation of Iraq began. Carlyle did not, as far as I can see on this statement, they did not disclose that they were in negotiations with one of Iraq's major debt holders, and they were about to submit a proposal to help secure these debts. Now, at the time of James Baker's appointment, the Carlyle Group could have recused itself. They could have told the rest of the consortium members, because of Mr. Baker's appointment, we can no longer be involved in anything having to do with Iraq's debts because it obviously presents a conflict of interest. Or James Baker could have resigned, as the New York Times called him to do, to prevent exactly this kind of a scenario from cropping up. Neither of those things happened.
Let's talk about what happened after this break. Yeah. Naomi Klein, okay. Nation columnist and author, major expose went up on the Nation website last night. This is the first broadcast of this story in this country. Naomi Klein joining us from our Toronto studio. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with her. Find out what happened, also about that trip that James Baker took on January 21st, 2004, and then also what is the role of the former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. Stay with us.
Nowadays, this led us to the editor. Texas is the best that we can do.
America version 6.0, Steve Earle here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we continue with this nation expose by nation columnist Naomi Klein, author and filmmaker. She joins us from our Toronto studio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to hear about the double life of James Baker, documents obtained by The Nation magazine reveal that the Bush envoy has a private interest in the Iraqi debt. Naomi Klein, continue.
So we got to the point where Carlisle had submitted their statement. James Baker was appointed debt envoy, and he did not resign from the Carlisle Group, and the Carlisle Group did not resign from this consortium that was trying to convince the government of Kuwait that it should allow it to become its chief lobbyists to the world, to the United Nations, to members of the Security Council. And that's very important to understand, because the Security Council has the power to stop reparations from Iraq to Kuwait at any time. These reparation payments are entirely at the discretion of the Security Council. So essentially what they were in communications with the government of Kuwait about was how they could access high-level people at the Carlisle Group. And as we know, the Carlisle Group is often called the ex-president's club, because it has people associated with it, like the president's father, like John Major, like James Baker. And so that was what they were doing. And in the documents, it says, previously to James Baker's appointment, Frank Carlucci, who is the chairman emeritus of the Carlisle Group and also former Secretary of Defense, had been engaged, and they say, in a convening role for the Carlisle Group. But after Secretary Baker's appointment as debt envoy, the optics had to change. And the way the optics changed is that Carlisle no longer was publicly involved as a lobbyist. They said that their only role in the consortium was going to be to manage the investments. Now, this is kind of strange, because as you said at the top, Amy, we're talking about a huge amount of money going to the Carlisle Group, $1 billion in investment. Now, even for a company like the Carlisle Group, $1 billion represents 10% of all of their equity investments. So this is a very, very big deal that they're landing. But they said that all they would do is manage this money for the government of Kuwait. And this presented a problem for the consortium, because, of course, really, one of the people who I showed this deal to, Jerome Levinson, who's a very respected international law professor with experience in this area, he described it as influence peddling of the crassest kind. But they had this problem, which is that the Carlisle Group couldn't openly admit that it was involved in lobbying. So they needed to find another politically connected firm. And on December the 1st, which was 4 days before Secretary Baker's appointment was publicly announced, the consortium reached out to the Albright Group. The Albright Group is the consulting firm that is headed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and is also populated by many powerful ex-politicians. And the Albright Group signed on to basically take the lead in the lobbying and public relations effort involved in this deal, so that the Carlisle Group could only deal with the money part of it. And I had a really interesting exchange yesterday with Chris Ullman, who is the vice president and chief spokesperson for the Carlisle Group, where he told me that the Carlisle Group would not be engaged in lobbying at all and was not involved in any way in trying to secure the deal. So I asked him, so what you're saying is that you were willing to take the $1 billion, but you weren't willing to try to get it. And he said, that's correct. But of course, as I said before, $1 billion is a huge investment for the Carlisle Group. So obviously they were very interested in how these negotiations were proceeding.
And how has the Albright Group responded? What is it that they are saying about this relationship they have with the Carlisle Group and Kuwait and Iraq right now?
Well, they're not publicly admitting that they were brought in as political cover. It looks to me as if the Albright Group was brought in as political cover by the consortium so that attention would be taken away from the Carlyle Group, and to fill this gap, because the Carlyle Group could not publicly be engaged in lobbying to secure Iraq's debt at the same time as James Baker was asking the world to forgive those debts. But of course, we're really splitting hairs here, because the Carlyle Group was part of this consortium, and the consortium's main pitch to the government of Kuwait, and we have the documents to prove it, was saying, look, you will not be able to secure these debts on your own. In fact, they say that they talked to financial experts and told them that the $27 billion that Kuwait is owed in reparation awards at this point would be worth, if they were to try to sell it on the market, $1.5 billion. So it would be discounted to the tune of 90% if they tried to do this on their own. But they said, because we are so politically connected, we will be able to get a portion of these reparations payments for you. So it's a trade, really, of influence for money, as well as investment expertise and public relations. That's essentially what's outlined in the proposal. And the documents are actually already online on the Guardian website if people want to take a look at them. Now, the Albright Group, their position is that Madeleine Albright, as Secretary of State, was involved in securing these reparations, and that's true. In fact, Madeleine Albright was the main author of the Security Council resolution that created the Oil for Food program, which diverted 30% of Iraq's oil revenue to these reparation payments. And they say that it's not a conflict of interest. But of course, U.S. policy has changed, and now U.S. policy is to get as much debt forgiveness for Iraq as possible. So what you have are two former secretaries of state, both of whom had key roles, of course, in the invasion, the first war, the first Gulf War, in the case of James Baker, the ceasefire that forced Iraq to pay these reparations, and then you have Madeleine Albright, who enforced the sanctions regime and the reparation payments, both of them part of the same deal to now get a piece of those reparation payments that they themselves helped to secure. So it's quite shocking. The Albright Group, just to be clear, they say that they are involved in this deal because they believe that the Kuwaitis deserve reparation payments and that they were essentially on a humanitarian mission. Now, I think it's very important to understand that these reparation payments, there are genuine humanitarian and environmental claims being made before the United Nations Compensation Commission. But the vast majority of the money has been going to oil companies. It's been going, there's the largest single award was $15.9 billion to Kuwait's national oil company for lost revenue during the occupation of Kuwait. What the Compensation Commission didn't assess was how much Kuwait's oil industry gained during the long embargo against Iraq, because they were able to sell much more oil. The United Nations Compensation Commission is a very controversial body. It's a quasi-tribunal with very, very little oversight. So we've seen things like Texaco receiving an award of $505 million, once again, for losses, lost revenue, damage, things like this. It's actually become a bit of a slush fund for corporate America. And as I've been learning more about the reparation payments that Iraq has been paying, I've come to understand why corporate America hasn't, during the embargo, during the sanctions, during the 90s, why they didn't make more of a fuss about not being able to invest in Iraq, because they were collecting losses in Geneva at the United Nations Compensation Commission for billions of dollars. You have awards being given to Kentucky Fried Chicken, to Toys R Us, to companies like this, simply for lost revenue that they would have made if Iraq had not invaded Kuwait.
We're talking to Naomi Klein. That trip that former Secretary of State James Baker, now the envoy for President Bush, took January 21st, 2004.
Yeah, no, the timing of this is really quite staggering. And we remember when George Bush sent James Baker on his noble mission. First he went to Europe, and then he went to the Middle East. On January 21st, he arrived in Kuwait. He spent the morning in Kuwait, and then he went on to Saudi Arabia. When he was in Kuwait, he met with the prime minister, and he met with the foreign minister and several other officials to talk about debt forgiveness, to ask them to forgive Iraq's debts. At the very same time, on January 21st, according to these documents, and I had this confirmed yesterday, the consortium, a woman named Shahamin Sheikh, the head of the consortium, hand-delivered this proposal to Iraq, to Kuwait's foreign minister. So as James Baker was meeting with the foreign minister, on the same day, the foreign minister receives a proposal from the Carlyle Group, the Albright Group, all these other players, including Fidelity Investments, and so on, saying, actually, we will help you to get Iraq to pay its debts to Kuwait. So they're getting this clear mixed message. You have James Baker, the envoy, saying, forgive Iraq's debts, and then you have a document that talks about James Baker extensively. He's mentioned at least a half a dozen times about both the risk that he presents as envoy, but also he's listed, when they talk about the consortium members and all the powerful people that this consortium will bring to the table on behalf of the government of Kuwait, James Baker is listed there. So you have James Baker, who is both the stick in the form of the threat that Kuwait will lose its debt payments, and the carrot in the form of, if you sign with us, if you give a $1 billion investment to the Carlyle Group, then you will have James Baker on your side. And I asked Shahamin Sheikh about this timing, why it was that she delivered the proposal on the same day that James Baker, the one day that James Baker was in Kuwait. And she said it was just a coincidence. She said, I was in the region, and so I just stopped by on my way to Europe.
Naomi Klein, what now? Will Carlyle get the contract? What is the Kuwaiti government saying?
The Kuwaiti government is saying, I spoke to the undersecretary for the prime minister of Kuwait, who told me that it is still being considered. He said he read the proposal, was fully aware of it. I asked him, actually, whether they were confused by this dual role that James Baker was playing. I said, who did you think you were meeting with? Were you meeting with James Baker, the envoy, or were you meeting with James Baker, the businessman? Because after that meeting, interestingly, Kuwait's foreign minister said that James Baker had shown understanding about Kuwait's position on war reparations. So we know it came up in the meeting. There was a long pause when I asked him about this, and he said that he wasn't able to comment and that he hopes that I understand. And I understood from his tone that from Kuwait's perspective, it's not just that James Baker can help them. It's also that James Baker can hurt them. I mean, this is the essence of a conflict of interest, is that they're not just saying, sign with us because we can help you. The implication, of course, because they've already presented James Baker as a threat to the government of Kuwait, is if you don't accept this deal, it could backfire on you quite seriously. So that's exactly why arrangements like this are supposed to be barred under U.S. Regulations against what's called the revolving door. But what's interesting about this case is that James Baker didn't even wait for the door to revolve. I mean, he was in the envoy post while this deal was being put forward. So I think the timing is interesting, Amy. The debates are tonight, and it happens that James Baker is now much less concentrated on Iraq's debt and is now concentrated on the debates, because he's head of George Bush's debate team. And I think he is the president's special envoy. That's his post. So if the president's special envoy is in a direct conflict of interest and has been representing the president in this way, obviously it reflects directly on the president. So I think the next stage is, I hope someone will put some of these questions to the president.
Well, Naomi, I don't think that either the Democrats or Republicans, Kerry or Bush, will be raising this in the debate tonight, given the bipartisan nature of the involvement here. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Naomi Klein, an explosive expose on the Nation magazine website, also front page of the Guardian newspaper today. This is the first time the story is being broadcast. Naomi Klein speaking to us from Toronto. Naomi Klein, Nation magazine columnist, author of several books, and filmmaker The Take is her new film. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to another breaking story, as millions of Americans sit down in front of their TVs in the coming days to watch their favorite primetime shows, many of them will instead be made to watch a controversial new documentary criticizing John Kerry's record in Vietnam. That's because the nation's largest local television chain, the Sinclair Broadcasting Group, ordered its 62 TV stations to preempt regular primetime programming in favor of airing the film Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal. The documentary was produced by Carlton Sherwood, a former Washington Times reporter who used to work for the Department of Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge when he was governor of Pennsylvania. This week, 18 Democratic senators urged the Federal Communications Commission to investigate Sinclair's decision to air what they view as an unpaid 90-minute attack ad against Kerry. Sinclair's television outlets reach nearly a quarter of the nation's homes, including many in key swing states, such as Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. FCC Commissioner Michael Copps released a statement calling Sinclair's decision to air the program a, quote, abuse of public trust. This marks the second time this year Sinclair made headlines for its programming decisions. In April, the network refused to run an episode of Nightline when the anchor, Ted Koppel, read the names of every U.S. soldier killed in Iraq. We turn now to Danny Schechter, executive director of MediaChannel.org. He's been covering the Sinclair Broadcasting controversy closely. Tell us, Danny Schechter, your latest piece. Sinclair plays fast and loose with the news. Your response.
Well, you know, the problem here is that they're packaging this as news. You know, if they were simply saying, okay, here's another point of view documentary that we're making available to viewers, that might be one thing if they also open their airwaves to other point-of-view documentaries, which, of course, they do not. So in the context of how this is being presented, it's clearly a political act. And in a sense, there's nothing illegal about it, given the fact that we've had so much deregulation for so long of broadcast, and standards have been eroded. The traditions of so-called objectivity, which we all know, you know, are rarely practiced but often spoken of, you know, have been eroded as well. So this is one more nail in the coffin of traditional mainstream television broadcasting as we see more and more polarization on the airwaves, which mirrors in a way the polarization in the country, only their megaphone is louder because they own more TV properties. They, of course, this company is a beneficiary of the rules that have allowed for more media concentration. They have a lot of the prominent investors. Media Channel has a list, and I've been listing all the owners of Sinclair Broadcasting. There are various boycott calls in effect. There's going to be a coalition meeting to try to actually seek to deny their license, broadcast licenses. On the other side, Rush Limbaugh has sent out a, you know, urgent message to all of his ditto heads, urging them to support Sinclair Broadcasting. So once again, you know, from attack by the loony left. So, you know, once again, media issue has become a political issue, and it's a big, major attack in a sense, not only on the traditions of what supposedly is news, but also shows how media power is often shaping the discourse of our whole election. We just had, you know, weeks of the Swift Boat veterans also trashing John Kerry's history. And here's a documentary which seeks to keep alive, you know, the kind of bitterness of the Vietnam War, which is most people, you know, have left behind. So that's an important issue. What I'm doing, Amy, is I am writing today to the chairman of Sinclair Broadcasting and saying, look, if you want to run a point-of-view documentary about the Vietnam War, how about running one about the Iraq War? And my new film, WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, is coming out in New York this month, and I'm offering it to Sinclair. And also, I'm willing to go on the panel on Sinclair and debate these people, because what they're doing is outrageous. Everybody knows it. It's just a power move and a political partisan move in the name of news and in the name of independent media, which of course it isn't. It's ironic that the head of Mr. Smith, the head of Sinclair, has also criticized what he calls the dumbing down of news. But his view is, you know,
instead of the dumbing down of news, the entertainment direction of news, he wants to add more right-wing content to the mix.
We're talking to Danny Schechter, executive director of MediaChannel.org, about Sinclair Broadcasting. We'll be back with him and others in a minute.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. That's Gil Scott-Heron. The revolution will not be televised. As we continue with Danny Schechter, executive director of MediaChannel.org, covering the Sinclair Broadcasting controversy, stations owned by Sinclair, there are 62 of them, being told they have to air this documentary against Kerry about his Vietnam War record. We're also joined by Wally Bowen, a media activist and lead organizer of the Sinclair Media Watch, a grassroots citizens group formed in Asheville, North Carolina, to evaluate local news coverage provided by WLOS-TV, the only broadcast TV station based in Asheville, North Carolina. Their evaluation will be published and shared with the FCC during the public comment period for the renewal of the station's license. Your response, Wally Bowen, to this latest controversy and why you have been taking on Sinclair Broadcasting for quite a while now.
Well, Amy, as you said, this is the only commercial TV license assigned to this region of North Carolina, and it's quite a large mountainous region, and citizens in this mountain region, you know, rely heavily on this one TV station, and since Sinclair took it over, we've seen a marked shift in the news coverage, and it's clear that the coverage is not being determined by the local journalists and editors, but it's being called, the shots are being called from Baltimore. So the community is very, very concerned about this. And as Danny was saying, this is a public resource. This broadcast spectrum is you know, a public interest, part of the public trust. And this is one of the most blatant abuses of this public trust in the 70 years since Congress entrusted it to these private companies.
Danny Schechter, your response to the local struggle in the context of this bigger story of Sinclair Broadcasting telling its 62 stations that they're to run this documentary produced by the Washington Times reporter who formerly worked for Tom Ridge, who's now director of Homeland Security, was the governor of Pennsylvania.
This documentary producer also did, I think, a film, as I recall, glorifying Reverend Moon. You know, see, he has a long history as a hard right ideologue, not as a journalist, as far as, you know, broadcast journalism goes. And, you know, Sinclair is just taking all this to the next level. We've seen the erosion of news on news programs. Some years ago, Rocky Mountain Media Watch out in Denver did an analysis of local news in that market and found that the thing that was missing in their local news was news. And they actually sued on the grounds of false advertising, saying that they were claiming to be a news program when the content analysis showed that it wasn't news, or very little news was part of the mix. And, you know, this is now basically, you know, people with a great deal of power in centralized operations dictating a political line. We see it at Fox News. We see it here. But, you know, it's only part of a much larger pattern, you know, of disengaging from covering the world, disengaging from offering analysis, more pundits, you know, than reporters, less investigative reporting, shorter stories, more news in less time. All of this is a way of trying to dumb down and move the whole population to the right, depoliticize America. That's why media issues are so important for those of us who want to change things in America to take a stand on and to become engaged with. We set up at Media Channel something called Media for Democracy. It's a network like Move On the Media, okay? Media for Democracy, 4 months ago. We now have 60,000 members who are sending emails, who are getting engaged on these media issues. The Media Channel has a lot of resources online about how to get involved and get engaged, because this is something which, if it is not stopped, if we're just not paying attention to this, is going to get a lot worse. You know, Democracy Now! Is like a lone voice in the wilderness in many instances, and what the right wing has is an echo chamber. It has, you know, Sinclair has 62 stations, you know.
Denny, I'm going to interrupt to share with you what Sinclair's Mark Hyman said this morning. We had called and asked him to come on the show. He didn't. We called all levels of Sinclair to try to get someone on. But he did go on CNN this morning when asked if this is basically an in-kind contribution to the President Bush campaign. This is what he responded. He said, if you use that logic and reasoning, that means every car bomb in Iraq would be an in-kind contribution to John Kerry. Weak job performance ratings that came out last month would have been an in-kind contribution to John Kerry, and that's just nonsense, Sinclair's Hyman said. He went on to say, this is news. I can't change the fact that these people decided to come forward today. The networks had this opportunity over a month ago to speak with these people. They chose to suppress them. They chose to ignore them. They are acting like Holocaust deniers, pretending these men don't exist. Those are the words of Mark Hyman of Sinclair Broadcasting today on CNN.
Holocaust denial is pretty strong, and I think that gives you an idea of the mindset here. Look, there have been people who supported the Vietnam War then, who support it now, who spoke out against John Kerry, spoke out against Vietnam veterans, against the war. This is nothing new. There's nothing news about that particularly. This debate has been going on for over 30 years. The fact of the matter is that most Americans, Vietnam is not even a war anymore. It's an era, the Vietnam era. Nobody wants to even talk about the war because America lost the war. To blame John Kerry for that is ridiculous. To blame, you know, the soldiers that opposed the war for that is Orwellian and insane.
Danny Schechter, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of MediaChannel.org, and Wally Bowen. Your website is?
SinclairWatch.com.
Thanks for being with us as we move now to our last story. President Bush and Senator Kerry meet today in Arizona for the third and final presidential debate of the campaign. The encounter, which is being held at Arizona State University in Tempe, will focus on domestic issues including jobs, health care, and taxes. In the weeks leading up to the final debate, FBI agents have been knocking on the doors of hundreds of Muslims in the key swing state of Arizona and conducting so-called voluntary interviews, as well as revisiting mosques and what they say is a new initiative to thwart terrorist attacks. The FBI plan, officially known as the Fall Threat Task Force, but dubbed by critics as October Plan, is not just confined to Arizona. With just a few weeks left to go before the election, so-called interviews of individuals in Arab and Muslim communities taking place all over the country. There's a growing concern the new government plan could silence political expression in Muslim communities before the election. We turn to Deidre Aboud, Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Arizona. Can you tell us more? Who is being interviewed?
Pretty much everybody that's Muslim. It started out, I mean, we've had waves over the years since September 11th. We recognize a wave because instead of getting one or two people a week reporting that they're being interviewed, we get 10 a day. They started out mainly when we were going to war in Iraq or getting ready. They sent out that we're going to interview all the Iraqis. When things happen internationally, we start seeing them focus on a particular country. We get a lot of people from Pakistan come in at one time and say, you know, we're being questioned, or Somalia or Sudan. This summer, it somewhat intensified on different levels. One of those levels was converts were included. Anyone who was a convert, anyone who had ever traveled to certain countries started being questioned. And not only were they questioned, but they were also told that, there were some of them that were told, we don't think that you're doing anything wrong, but we think maybe some of your friends aren't necessarily good people. And that following saying a list of 10 people asking if you knew them, knowing that they're your friends and they were at your house for dinner just last week.
I wanted to bring in Yasser Alamoudi, who just was visited by the FBI, 27 years old, immigrant from Yemen, grew up in Saudi Arabia, came to the U.S. for university study 7 years ago. When did this happen, Yasser, and what were you asked? Who came to your door?
It took place sometime in July. It was about 9 p.m. at night, just on a normal weekday. And he just showed up at my house unexpectedly, unannounced, just saying that he was an FBI agent and he needed to have a chat with me about just certain questions that he has. When I asked him what kind of why me of all people, he said that my name showed up on some sort of a list that his agency maintains. He said he works for the U.S. Joint Task Force on Terrorism. And so I welcomed him, and we sat down, and he kept asking a lot of questions about whether I knew anybody who just came back from Pakistan or anybody who showed interest in a government building or anybody who wishes to do any some harm on American soil. I mean, it was just basically very general questions, very vague, very ambiguous.
Deirdre Abood, do you think this is meant to suppress voting in the Muslim community, just overall generating a kind of fear?
I surely hope not. And I'm doing everything that I can here, and as CARE is nationally, to try to encourage the Muslims not to allow that. Unfortunately, Muslims, they do have somewhat of an immigrant population, but it's not just immigrants. Even converts are very hesitant to speak out. They're so paranoid of being part of lists. And since they don't know the origin of lists or how they get on lists, they're concerned about everything. They're thinking if they register to vote, they're on a list. And if they go vote, that some of the questions are, how do you feel about the President of the United States? That indicates that there's a wrong answer. So that's making people think, well, so if I go vote and I vote against President Bush, is that going to get me on a list? And I'm trying to assure them that they know you voted, but they're not supposed to know who you voted for.
Deirdre Abood, Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Arizona, Yasser Alamoudi, one of those who was visited. Are people being locked up, Deirdre?
We haven't had really reports here in Arizona about people being locked up. However, when the BCIS sent out their little memo saying that they're going to arrest a lot of people who have immigration violations that also have some kind of a criminal activity, be it minor, they're going to pick these up, you know, to help with terrorism. And immediately here in Arizona, we had two Pakistani sisters who had no criminal record who, from what we can tell, we're not even out of status, but if they were, it was just a few days. And they were in the process and had paperwork from BCIS showing that they were in process of getting waivers. And they were picked up and taken to jail and had to have a bond, still don't know what their status is, still have never seen an attorney, and they're like 21 and 23.
Deirdre Abood, we have to leave it there, but it's a story that we continue to follow. Deirdre Abood, Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Yasser Alamoudi, one of those who's been visited by the federal authorities. I want to thank you both for being with us. I also want to welcome Vermont listeners to this broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernethy are our engineers. Thursday night will be in Toronto, on Friday at the Congregational Church in Berkeley, on Saturday in Marin, on Sunday in Ithaca and Rochester. Looking forward to seeing you all there. Go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.